Hello, today is Wednesday, May 13th, and that means that we're going to dive into the genealogy of Jesus that we see in Matthew chapter 1. And so far, we have studied two of the four women that are in the genealogy. And we're going to break that pattern today by looking at one of the kings, King Asa. He was a king of Judah. So grab a Bible, grab your family, and settle in. Before we get started, I just want to apologize if I look like I'm doing something weird or if I keep moving my head around. I don't know why, but today I can't seem to get my glasses to stop reflecting light, and I'm really kind of self-conscious about it right now. So if I'm just kind of bobbing my head back and forth, it's because I'm trying to get the reflection off my glasses of the light. So just ignore me if I look like I'm being weird and try and focus on what it is we're talking about today. So get your Bible, go ahead and open it up to the book of Second Chronicles. We're going to start in or be in chapters 14, 15, and 16. Like most of the kings of Judah, Asa's reign is recorded in two different places, once in Kings and once in Chronicles. The entire account of Asa's reign is in 1 Kings, is in chapter 15, and it's only 15 verses. But the account in Chronicles is much more expansive. It's three chapters, 14, 15, and 16, and it gives us a much wider glimpse of Asa and his reign. And so that's where we're going to spend most of our time today. Now, my last couple videos have been about 20 minutes long, and I'm trying to cut this one back down to about the 10, 15 minute range. We'll see what happens. I'm going to try and move through this a little quicker than we have been. So let's go ahead and just jump right in. We learn right away in 2 Chronicles 14:2 that Asa was a good king. It says, "And Asa did what was right in the eyes of the Lord his God." Now, Asa was only the third king of Judah, but idolatry had already crept in. So the kingdom divided under Rehoboam. And idolatry is just running rampant by the time Asa becomes king. But Asa, in these first few verses of chapter 14, we see that he removes idolatry. He casts it out as much as he can. And while he doesn't succeed in getting all of it out, his zeal for worshiping God and God alone is commendable. He commands the people to only worship God. Asa's heart was with the Lord, and he was so committed to following God that he actually removed his own mother from her royal position because she had made an image of worship for a false god. The text tells us at the end of chapter 15 that Asa's heart was with God. It was wholly true all of his days. So first and foremost, we see that Asa's range was or Asa Asa's reign was characterized by true worship of God. But it was also characterized as a time of peace. The first 10 years of Asa's reign, Judah experienced peace. There was no wars. But after that, Zerah, an Ethiopian king, came against him. And the text tells us that his army was of 1 million men. That's nearly twice the fighting force that Asa had under his command. But listen to what Asa does as the battle lines are drawn. And this is in 2 Chronicles chapter 14, verse 11. "And Asa cried to the Lord his God, 'O Lord, there is none like you to help between the mighty and the weak. Help us, O Lord our God, for we rely on you. And in your name we have come against this multitude. O Lord, you are our God. Let not man prevail against you.'" That is an astounding prayer. So I just want to break it down for a second. First, we see that Asa praises God and acknowledges that there is none like him. Only Yahweh has the power to help. None rivals his power. There is none like you. He is God alone. Then he admits his own shortcomings and dependence on God. He says, "We rely on you. We are not relying on our own strength. We have no chance in this battle. If we win, it is going to be because of you. We come in the name of the Lord, not in the name of Judah or in the name of Asa, but in the name of the Lord. And then there's the plea. Let not man prevail against you. Do not allow the wicked, evil, insignificant threat of man come against you and prevail upon your people. Let your name be known, your power made visible, your glory seen throughout the earth. And the Lord answers. The Ethiopians are defeated by God, and they flee. The army of Asa pursues and kills them all. They even plunder the surrounding cities as they pursue the army, and they bring back riches and livestock. Judah is made richer because of this battle that they face. Following this, Asa and Judah enjoyed peace until the 36th year of Asa's reign. For 36 years, Asa has done everything right. Judah has prospered under his reign. They have enjoyed peace outside of this one war. And they are worshiping the Lord. But in the 36th year of Asa's reign, Baasha, the king of Israel, built and fortified Ramah, which was a fortification between Israel and Judah along the border. And this was to prevent travel between the two nations, and it would effectively isolate Judah. Now, this is clearly a wicked and hostile move by the king of Israel. There's no reason for him to do this. But this is where Asa makes his critical mistake. For 36 years, he had been a good king. He has done the right thing. And if I just imagine if he had prayed the prayer that he prayed against the Ethiopians here, things might have gone differently. But instead of seeking the Lord, Asa gathers up treasures from the temple and sends them to Ben-Hadad, who was the king of Syria. Now, Syria had an alliance with Israel, the northern 10 tribes. And so he's bribing the king of Syria to break his alliance with Israel. And when this happens, Israel will no longer be secure as secure as they once were. And so Baasha has no choice but to withdraw from Ramah. And so that's what happens. And Asa is actually able to go and take all of the building materials from Ramah and to build his own defenses along the border against Israel. But God is displeased by this. And so he sends the prophet Hanani to speak to Asa. And so this is recorded in 2 Chronicles 16, verse 7. It says, "At that time, Hanani, the seer, came to Asa, king of Judah, and said to him, 'Because you have relied on the king of Syria and did not rely on the Lord your God, the army of the king of Syria has escaped you. Were not the Ethiopians and the Libyans a huge army with very many chariots and horsemen? Yet because you relied on the Lord, he gave them into your hand. For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the earth to give strong support to those whose heart is blameless toward him. You have done foolishly in this, for from now on you will have wars.' Then Asa was angry with the seer and put him in the stocks in prison, for he was in a rage with him because of this. And Asa inflicted cruelties upon some people at the same time." Asa failed to trust God. He had forgotten why he had enjoyed such a prosperous reign to begin with, why he had enjoyed such peace. It wasn't due to his wisdom or his strength. It was because of God. God had delivered the people and he had protected them. And Asa forgot it. He came up with his own plan to protect the nation instead of trusting God. And we see that God had planned to deliver them. Hanani tells Asa that the army of the Syrian king had escaped from his hand. God was going to use Judah's army to bring down Syria. He was going to give them great victory if they had trusted them. But Asa, rather than repenting, doubles down on his mistake. He gets angry and he throws Hanani, who is merely the messenger, into prison, and he begins to mistreat the people. Asa's pride is wounded and his anger flares up. Ace's reign comes to a sad end when we are told that he has a disease. And even in his sickness, he did not seek the Lord, but he turned only to physicians. For 36 years, Asa was a great king, but the final 3 years of his reign are full of turmoil, and they're characterized by his pride and anger. And so what does this king have to do with us today? So I just want to make a couple of points of applications. The first from the beginning of his reign and the second from his end. First, we see that we can and we should rely on God. No matter what we are facing, we can trust God. Asa faced down an army that was twice his size, and he was granted victory because he trusted God. Our God is powerful, our God is strong, and our God is compassionate. Listen again to part of the rebuke of Asa. For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to give strong support to those whose heart is blameless toward him. That is a God that Asa ignored. Nothing goes unnoticed by our God. He helps his people. We can trust God with whatever we are facing. It could be this sickness. It could be worrying about finances. It could be worrying about your family. It could be any type of decision. If you seek God, he will give you support. Now, this isn't a promise that we can get whatever we want if we seek God. But if we seek him with sincere hearts and we trust in him to deliver us, he will help us. He will be there as a leader and a guide for us. And that brings us to our second point. Asa did everything that he was supposed to do for 36 years. And then, to put it bluntly, he blew it. He messed up. And not only did he mess up, he didn't repent, he dug in. This is a powerful reminder for us that past successes do not guarantee future results. Just because you have done something right in the past does not mean that you are always going to do the right thing. We cannot sit complacently where we are and just assume that we are going to do the right thing. We can't just assume that we will never falter, that we will never give in to temptation because we have succeeded in the past. This is pride. We must fight against sin and pride every day. Every morning is a battle. The battle against sin is not an easy one. The Christian life and our fight against sin isn't just a lazy river that you just hop on a tube, the tube of the gospel, and float down comfortably. It's trying to swim upstream. And the moment you stop swimming, you lose. You start to drift back down river. We have to always fight against sin. One of my favorite people in history is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. In probably his most famous work, The Cost of Discipleship, he writes, "Thus it begins. The cross is not a terrible end to an otherwise God-fearing and happy life, but it meets us at the beginning of our communion with Christ. When Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die." That is our calling. Come and die. Die to self daily. Focus on Christ. Don't become complacent. Don't try and skirt by on past successes. Be aware of the sin that dwells within you and kill it daily. Don't become like Asa, whose pride and anger grew and grew and grew, and when he was confronted in it, dug in and took it out on those around him. Don't allow yourself to become like that. We must preach the gospel to ourselves daily. Remind yourself that you are a sinner in need of saving. I like to describe myself as a dirty, rotten sinner. We are all sinners, and it is only through God's grace on a wretched worm like you and like me that we have any hope. If we remember this, we will never stop fighting against our sin, and especially against our pride that seeks to devour us. We must Rejoice in God's grace. Always. Now I want to make one more point before we finish. We are not only to preach the gospel to ourselves and to rejoice in God's grace for ourselves, but we are to be bringers of this grace to one another. Bonhoeffer wrote another book. It's called Life Together. We did this with our small group, and don't listen to what any of them say. It's a great book. they didn't care for his writing style, but it's really good. I encourage you to read it. There's a copy of it in the library under Pastor Paul's Picks. Every once in a while, I just sneak a book in there, and this is one of them. And so I would encourage you to go and read it. But I just want to read one quick passage from it. It says, and that also clarifies the goal of all Christian community. They meet one another as bringers of the message of salvation. As such, God permits them to meet together and gives them community. Their fellowship is founded solely upon Jesus Christ and this alien righteousness. All we can say, therefore, is the community of Christians springs solely from the biblical and Reformation message of the justification of man through grace alone. This alone is the basis of the longing of Christians for one another. We are called to be bringers of grace. All of our community, our fellowship, everything should be based on the fact that each of us are sinners saved by grace. We remind one another of the grace that we have received, and we extend that grace to one another. We are all longing to gather together again. We want to be in the same room. I know I want to be in the same room with all of you. But we can still be the church, even though we can't gather. We can still experience Christian community in our homes and in our interactions with one another. Whether it's a phone call or video chat, writing a letter, the things that we share online, the way that we talk online. All of these things should be coated with the grace of God. A.W. Tozer wrote, if you burn down the church building and drive away all the people, you have not disturbed Christian worship at all. Keep a Christian from entering the church sanctuary, and you have not in the least bit hindered his worship. We carry our sanctuary with us. We never leave it. We do not enter into a building and then commence to worship. If you are not worshiping God on Monday morning as you worshiped him the day before, perhaps you are not worshiping him at all. Do not let this time apart hinder your worship. Don't let this time apart hinder our community. We can be bringers of the gospel message, both to ourselves, to our family, and to everyone we can, in any way that we can. We don't have to gather in this church building to be the church. We can still love one another, we can show grace to one another, and we can encourage one another. Preach the gospel to yourself first, and then to others. And once again, rejoice in the grace of God. We'll see you next time.